Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History. This is a repeat episode of the podcast. We're reaching deep back into the archive. We are talking to national treasure, comedian, historian, broadcaster Al Murray. He's a great friend of this podcast. He's a great friend of mine, and he now has his own brilliant World War II podcast. We Have Ways of Making You Talk with the equally brilliant James Holland, so go and check that out. And we talked to him a couple of years ago about his love of history, his journey towards history, and his personal area of fascination, which is Arnhem. He's obsessed with Arnhem, the British-Polish Allied defeat at Arnhem in the autumn of 1944, in fact, which was 76 years ago this week. So it's a timely repeat, this one. We've produced hundreds of episodes of this podcast about the First and Second World Wars. And so what we decided to do is launch a new podcast. It's presented by historian Professor James Rogers. He's probably the world's leading expert on drones, by the way. He's been on this podcast a few times. Professor Rogers will be presenting this podcast called The World Wars. The World Wars. It's all of our episodes about the First and Second World War, talking to veterans, historians, people that lived through it, civilians, politicians. And it's also new episodes released each week that he'll be recording with some brilliant guests as well. So please go and check out The World Wars, part of the History Hit Network. Like it, rate it, all that junk. Wherever you get your pods. In the meantime, everyone, here is the brilliant Al Murray. Enjoy. So it all goes back to you. Very famous comedian, etc. History. I've been to many of your gigs. History runs like the writing through a stick of rock through those gigs. But you have written a great book about watching orphans and your dad. I mean, was that your entry into history?
Yeah, absolutely. My family is a family that talks about history at Sunday lunch, often to the annoyance of outsiders. And so I grew up in an environment that was where you would, and mainly talking about the Second World War, where that was a big topic of discussion, and argument as well, as much as anything else. So it was on my radar when I was about eight, because I went to see A Bridge Too Far at the cinema, and my father was an airborne soldier in the 50s and knew a load of the characters from the Battle of Arnhem, from 1st Airborne Division. Captain Mackay, who was at the bridge, fought in the school of the bridge, was my father's brigadier at one point, and Dad remembers him being shouted at by this guy. Anyway, so we went to the cinema to see this, because it was a portrayal of the whole maroon thing that my father, the maroon machine that my father was part of, and he sat there basically spluttering and cursing at the movie, and there was a great moment that I remember very clearly. When the tank comes over the bridge, and it's supposed to be a tiger, and it's a leopard from the 1960s, and he went, "It's the wrong bloody tank," and so that's where it all comes from that moment in the cinema. Growing up, going to Pegasus Bridge when I was 9 or 10, you know, Waterloo, I think when I was 12. This whole thing, you know, it was unavoidable in my family history.
And your grandfather had an interesting job in the war as well.
Well, as far as we know, This is the thing. My grandfather worked for PWE, the Political Warfare Establishment. I think he was part of the sort of the thing that was going on around Woburn Sands and Woburn rather than Bletchley. So they were the where the governments in exile were and all that sort of thing. And he was involved in black radio, He was in Vienna for some reason in May 1945. We don't really know why. He crops up all over. And there's a picture of him in a major's uniform in Cairo in 1942 or something. And he wasn't in the army. So who knows? And there's even a story that... There's a story about someone involved with the Yugoslav partisans who'd kind of crossed the line. Oh, there's a historian in Aberystwyth I talked to about this, about what my grandfather got up to. Some historian, this guy who crossed the line in his dealings with the Yugoslav partisans and then died mysteriously, possibly a heart attack. And my grandfather was around at the time. And who knows? And if you speak to my uncle will say, oh, there's definitely something fishy there. And you speak to my father, and my father's like, absolutely not. He was definitely not involved in that. And it's all quite murky and quite interesting. As well as having been a BBC man in the 30s before the war. So literally working alongside Dimbleby Sr. and doing all that sort of stuff.
I mean, my career would take such time for the better if I left the BBC and just started whacking Yugoslav partisans. Oh, it'd be joyful.
But what's interesting about it is when he died, my father, he'd asked my father to burn his papers, personal papers, when he died, and my dad did.
Oh.
Because my dad's from that...
Would you have just gone, sure, Dad?
He was from that mould of person that if his father asked him to do something like that, even with, you know, it'd be an absolute treasure trove of stuff. Absolutely, it's what you want me to do, and he did it.
Well.
Yeah, yeah. And he's since been researching him. And it's hard to find anything out because it was all secret.
Well, I burnt it all, Sam.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, okay, exactly.
Like Kafka-esque. Yeah, the rest of life. So you are in your own right an expert, I would say, on Arnhem. I mean, you've crossed swords with the best of them. We've had Anthony Beaver on the podcast saying it was all disastrous from the start. It never have worked. The whole thing was a joke. Where do you stand on that controversy?
If they'd gone a week earlier, I think we'd be looking at a very different story. With that operational plan, right? If they'd gone just a week earlier, because the Germans were still on the hop a week earlier, and there's a week's coagulation in certainly the German command structures. There's a very interesting book of essays that John Buckley has edited about Arnhem. It was in the last couple of years, and one of the essays is called "A Week Too Soon?" And then there's, I mean, the other thing is, there's the controversy over the airlift plan, and was that what the army wanted, or what the air force?
Yeah.
And the thing is there's an RAF historian who's since gone through all that, a guy called Seb Ritchie, who's since gone through the actual genesis of the airlift plan, and what's very interesting about it is the army asked for that airlift plan. They say they want that. What went wrong in Normandy is what went wrong in Sicily is the drops were scattered. What went wrong in Normandy is the drops were scattered. Could we just all land in the same place together just this once, please? And the Air Force give them exactly what they want. And then, of course, after the event, the army blame it all on the Air Force. They wouldn't let us land where we wanted to. But that's not really what happened. And Ritchie also looks into one of the intelligence myths, which is the overflights. And because he's an RAF historian, and he's obviously thought, enough's enough. So he's gone through all the RAF reconnaissance logs for overflights, you know, where they take picture of Panzer SS units around on them. He cannot find a single flight that matches that description. He cannot find the photographs that matches. He's not to say it didn't happen, but there's no record of those flights that Urquhart, the intelligence officer, claims to have ordered happening. So that's quite interesting. And again, that's the RAF going, because he's an RAF historian, and you know they've copped all the literal and metaphorical flack around the Arnhem op. So he's just going, hang on a minute, let's just actually look at these things. And that's really interesting. I think Beaver's probably right. I think it's not the conception that's the problem with Arnhem. It's the realization, the actualization. You know, if they decided that a staggered lift was a bad idea, and that what you do is the assets you land on D-Day at Arnhem, that the air landing brigade and the parachute brigade, if you decide they're both going for the bridge rather than half of them having to stay behind and defend landing zones because of your second stage lift, you've got more chance of getting more people to the bridge, which is what it's all about. So I think that there's still miles to go with what you can say about Arnhem. I think it's not settled.
That's clear. I also, whenever I read military history, I think the best and most trivial, but also the best expression is Victory has 1,000 fathers. Oh, yeah. Defeat is an orphan.
Yeah.
And Arnhem, now, everybody can tell you what an absolute
yeah.
But, I mean, Manstein or, you know, Rundstedt's thrust through the Ardennes that reached the coast, you know, Guderian charge, crossing that. It was an extraordinarily risky.
Yep.
And talk about one single, you know, MSR.
Yep.
And
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yet it's hailed as the greatest victory. It's the most brilliant piece of military operation.
But to which I would say the thing that precedes Arnhem is the greatest ever armoured breakout, which is the breakout after Falaise. And the decision, I think the problem with Arnhem is exactly as you say. We look at it now, it's obviously never going to work. If you're making that decision in late August...
When the Germans
are done for, as far as you can tell, you've destroyed them in the West and you're doing... I can't remember which division it does. 90 miles. Does 90 miles in a day. So no wonder you're thinking, well, this is just going to keep going. And from September 1939, on the Allied side, there's been this idea that the Germans are going to collapse like a pack of cards any minute, right from the beginning of the Second World War. And that idea is still doing the rounds 6 years later, 4 years, 5 years later. It shouldn't be a surprise, I think.
Well, and also, you know that the Soviets are conquering and committing unimaginable brutality in Eastern Europe. So if you can get to Berlin first, you know, that's what's so fascinating about
it. I find it a forgivable mistake on Montgomery's part. Although, actually, I mean, and of course, you know, failure in this instance isn't an orphan. The buck is laid at stops at Montgomery all
it's
the time.
Although,
let's be honest, Ike approved it. So, you know, if we're gonna look for where the buck stops, it's got to be with Eisenhower. He says, okay, go for it, and you know, but this will never end. This will go on forever. And at Chalk Valley at the History Festival, we had a morning of Airborne Forces stuff. And the airborne archivist from the museum in Duxford comes over from the Air Assault Museum and says, oh, you must come and have a look at this stuff, because the thing no one likes to talk about is how bad officer relations were within 1st Airborne, how no one was talking to anybody, there was a Scottish clique and there was a parachute clique and a glider clique, and they're all at each other's throats in the run up to Market Garden. And then, of course, because it's all a terrible disaster, you're not going to write about that. That's not going to get into the history books because it would look... Because they fought incredibly gallantly, as we accept, but it would look like you were really you were rubbing their noses in it or adding salt to the wound. So there's still loads more about Arnhem to come out.
What I like about you, Alan, is you're I think working at the BBC is slightly, because there's a sense there that you can't just keep producing stuff about the Second World War. And so I quite admire guys like you and James Holland who just go, you know what, the Second World War is the largest conflict in the history of the human race.
Yeah.
It remodeled the city that I grew up in. My own family were involved in it. In my case, my dad was nearly killed by a V1 in about 44. So it's not surprising that we're quite interested.
Well,
right?
Yes.
And you are just like an unashamed...
But by the same token, where the Second World War sits in our culture at the moment is something that drives me mad.
Yeah.
And it's all very well being interested in it as a historical event, but using it rhetorically and using it politically... at the moment is wildly out of control and something that that really makes on the other hand, as well as I am being very interested, it makes me think I've got to stop being interested in this. We've got to move on from this somehow or historicise it and
But you do that through your comedy.
We try to.
And that's something that confuses people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Funnily enough, I had a conversation this morning when I said I was with the Western Front Association and all these people, massive fans of Al Murray. But they went, because they don't understand some bits of your comedy, because they don't kind of get who you are and which bit is you and which bit isn't and which is the pub landlord, which is one of the most recognisable comedy characters in the last 30 years in the UK. So how do you...
Well, I like the confusion. I think a big element in comedy should be mischief, confusion, ambivalence, chaos. We're supposed to be... Comedians aren't supposed to be... po-faced people with the answers to everything. They're supposed to sow discord and cause mischief, and people are meant to misunderstand you, and they're meant to not get the joke. You know, you can't get all the jokes. So I'm quite comfortable with the idea that some people don't get it, that some people think what I'm doing is absolutely ghastly. It's all right. It's fine. You know, comedians. if you look at the history of jesters, comedians used to have to eat on their own. They weren't allowed to sit even with the musicians. They had to eat on their own because they had no patron. They only had the king as a patron so that they would speak truth to power rather than be the Duke of Norfolk's jester and have other patronage so that, you know, that they could get to the king via the jester. And in that respect, comics should eat alone. They shouldn't sit with the minstrels and the jugglers and the jonglers and all those people. They should be on their own, wearing their motley outfit, wearing their tweed and sitting by themselves.
just tilting at everyone.
Absolutely. And you know, there's a really excellent book about jesters in the English court, and I can't remember who wrote it, but it'll come to me. Really, really fantastic book about that, which says, you know, this entire tradition that dies out during the Elizabethan era, when everything gets sort of theatricalised, turned into drama. There was this tradition of the, you know, the fool who had no patron but his master, so that he could have the licence to say what he wanted to his master. It wasn't answerable to anyone else. And in a way, if you're not causing confusion and pissing people off, you're not doing your job right. If you're not taking flak, you're not over the target.
Did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex Scandal in Society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
What do you say there? Because you, the pub landlord, is he like, well, what's he... The pub land. I mean, this is difficult. I mean, I've seen him a lot of times.
You've seen a lot of times.
And yeah. I see the gleam in the pub landlord's eye when I come in late, and I know I'm about to get some history related banter. You've had me on stage.
I don't have 100% control over him, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Especially as the evening goes on. Because he rips apart the Metropolitan Elite, but he also is as furious in his scathing in his criticism of you know, the so-called the people that have been left behind, you know, the people that we're told gave us Trump and Brexit.
Yeah, well, I suppose. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to. The thing is I when I'm writing it and the way I conceived it, it's first of all supposed to be a piece of entertainment. So you try and make as many different people laugh on as many different levels as you possibly can. But it's also in one respect supposed to be like a piece of satire, which is what led to me running for Parliament 3 years ago. And you can't satirise the politics we have in a pluralistic one man, one vote, democracy without satirising the people who are doing the voting. We're all part of the same fruitcake. And there's lumps of this in the lumps of one thing in a fruitcake in one place, lumps of but it's a whole. You can't just do the politicians. You've got to do the people that vote for them, and that's sort of my approach to it. And everyone, I think, to an extent, everyone in a pluralistic democracy where we kind of have lots of liberties and freedoms that don't exist everywhere else, kind of everyone's fair game. And the metric of whether you're punching up or punching down, which is the thing people like to talk about with comedy, is harder to work simplistically in a society like ours, I think. You know, because if boorish, idiotic people are dominating a debate, just because you're better educated than them doesn't mean you shouldn't take the piss out of them. Because if they're dominating the debate, they have power. They have the power, and you're, as a comic, you're supposed to talk truth to power. And if more educated people than you are being a dominating, you should take the piss out of them too. Or if, you know, slack-brained conservatives or pie-in-the-sky socialists are the people in power, then you have a duty, you know, as a comic, as the jester, as the mischief maker, as the disruptor. You know, the problem is you start talking about it, it all sounds quite pretentious quite quickly. Those should be your targets. And that's sort of what I try to do with the pub landlord. I mean, often I often miss, and I often get misunderstood, but I kind of, so what? You've still got to shoot at the damn thing.
History does run through your comedy.
I mean, oh, yeah.
Do you find that people, they respond to history? Do you understand what the sort of shared historical stories are? Like, you'd make jokes about the Second World War, but you probably wouldn't make a joke about Magna Carta.
Corn laws is off the limit. No one knows about the corn laws.
Okay. But there is, you know, like, there is a sort of orange squash, totemistic set of historical things. Henry VIII. If you go to Henry VIII, everyone knows what you're talking about. It might all be wrong, but everyone knows what you're talking about.
Head chopping wives,
telling the Pope to get knotted, right? The original Brexit, whatever you want to call it. So things like that, the Civil War, you know, Oliver Cromwell banning Christmas, everyone knows about that, okay, right? So there's a series of things, and because they're those, everyone knows about that things, we enter the territory of the uses and abuses of history, and which I think is as interesting as history itself. What history gets used for, how it gets abused, how it gets turned around and pointed at us in a different direction. How appeasement is wheeled out as a thing we must never do. And the thing is yes, if you agree with that picture of what was happening between 36 and 39, that is what you should never do. But there's much more to the story of what's called appeasement. Appeasement itself, as a diagnosis of those 3 years, it was a political diagnosis from people who wanted to besmirch the Chamberlain government, who you could argue ran this fantastic rearguard action to get to the point where we were able to deal with Nazi Germany. You could argue that. I mean, it's all, you can toss it in either direction. So I'm interested in that, you know, uses and abuses of history. It kind of in a way that comics always have been, because you're always looking for cultural touch points where, you know, you can definitely get people to they all know about something. Dennis Norden died quite recently, talked about in a really great interview. He said he started writing comedy after the Second World War, when you lived in essentially a monoculture, because everyone had been through the same thing. So finding things for everyone to laugh at was pretty easy, right? And that version of history is a thing I think everyone has in common. So you can push those buttons as sort of, you know, and it's our cultural bathwater.
There you go.
Of that history.
There you go. I haven't known that expression.
Don't drink the bathwater, though. That's where you end up like Boris Johnson, imagining you're Winston Churchill. Because he's definitely drunk the bathwater and may have peed in the bath before he did it.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord. His 14th century, now long repealed laws.
Yes, long repealed. But it doesn't matter, because no one knows. You know, that's what he's doing. I mean, in a way, he was doing what the pub landlord would do there. You know, I used to have this routine where I would prove historically that Great Britain, and he never calls it the UK, the pub landlord, because no one does, right? That Great Britain has, even though he obviously includes Northern Ireland in it, that Great Britain has defeated every single country in the world at war. And he does that as a, like, and you'd say, well, what about the War of 1812 against the United States? And so I'd do a whole load of waffle about the White House being, you know, attacked, burned down by the Royal Marines and blah, 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 blah. And anyway, they're our ally, and that counts as losing to us. You know, and that's what Boris is doing. He's using one, pulling out a thing, going, dazzle, dazzle, look at this, and then constructing an argument, even though it's rubbish. and you know, it's no coincidence that politicians do this, because they're looking for things to... They're looking for things, either things we all understand or all things we go, oh, that's interesting. And that Prime Munieri, wasn't it? Was he brought?
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Everyone goes, oh, yeah, that's interesting. No one's heard of it. Yeah. Of course they haven't. But they also expect it from that brand of conservative.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He knows his medieval history. And it turned out he didn't.
Yeah. Well, who does? I mean, who knows what happened in the Middle Ages? Nobody, not really.
You ran for office.
Yes,
you ran
I did.
For high office.
Yeah, well, no.
Remind me.
I think,
well, you ran for
office. Yeah.
You ran for office against Nigel Farage, the leader
and,
of the
UK. And all the other parties. Otherwise, on Twitter,
you're against Nigel. And how did it go? Remind me, how many votes did you get?
318. Which is a Kabbalic number that's in the Bible. I think at one point Abraham actually selects 318 warriors or something
like
that.
It's all getting a bit QAnon around it. You're going to be somewhere on a big whiteboard with some straying.
Yeah,
and some.
Absolutely.
So 318. Listen, man, that's 318 more people than ever voted for me. So,
well, but you would run as a Whig, wouldn't you? You'd run as
an old-fashioned Whig.
Proper old-fashioned Whig. Home rule for Ireland.
But as you... I mean, obviously, because as you get older, do you like getting in the cut and thrust of political discourse? I mean, is that kind of...
Well, it's something I got... It's something I've been drawn into more and more, I think. It used to be something that didn't bother me, but to be honest, a lot of the stuff that Pub Landlord was banging on about when I first started doing the act in the mid-90s, which was quite a big chunk of the act, was his sort of hallucinatory Euroscepticism, basically. And that I used to do that because that was sort of, I thought, an amusing fringe activity that kind of... Now it's mainstream.
So you were, like, making jokes about the WTO, weren't you?
You know, I used to go on about Maastricht and wanting to be a metric martyr, wanting to be arrested for using Imperial. You know, because that was the sort of... That was the flesh and blood of it... In the 90s, it was all about metric. It was all about weights and measures and this sort of foreign dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, so, but I had that in the act, and it was a fringe activity. And now the thing that the act used to be really concerned about is mainstream, is absolutely smack in the middle. So I've sort of been dragged into into relevance by events. I was quite happy being irrelevant.
And you probably took the piss out of socialists as well.
Absolutely. Although in lots of ways, the Pub Landlord is quite, he's quite an old Labour 1970s socialist.
Yes.
Or you know, he believes in an honest in the working man and all that sort of stuff in a ludicrous abstract way, of course. But so he's, because he's a mesh of all sorts of things. Because after all, a great deal of old Labourism was quite tied up in national ideas. You know, which is what David Edgerton's writing about at the moment. Really interestingly, that, you know, that you've got a national thing at the core of the Labour movement, right, certainly from the end of the Second World War, but that's a digression. So I found politics has dragged my act back into being relevant, having been, you know, quite, I was quite happy to wittering on about this stuff to myself and my audience and not really being anything to do with the main discourse, but now smack back in the middle, thanks to the likes of Nigel Farage.
Who
stole my act.
Stole your seat. He stole your seat.
Yeah.
Right, just last thing, we can't go because we're sitting in your lovely study and there is an enormous, enormous drum kit here. Just talk me through this passion, because this is something...
I've played the drums since I was a kid and on and off, and played in bands when I was at uni, and then after uni tried to be a musician for a bit and then realised I wasn't good enough, which is... I think it's always important in life, if you're not very good at something, realise that as soon as possible, and then you can... carry on enjoying it by not pursuing it to the point where you ruin it and you in the process. So I know lots of musicians who some days would rather not go near a musical instrument but have to. So anyway, so the long and the short of it is I met a drum maker 5 years ago. I was having one last drum set made that I would never do it again. 2 years later, his employment changed. It's the most polite way of putting it all. And I said to him the thing you should never say to anyone, well, if that happens, if they really do let you go, we should go into business together. And 3 weeks later, he rang me up.
God.
Were you serious about that? So we now have a factory in Stockport. We're called the British Drum Company. The drums are handmade in England. We make our own ply. We have our own cold press lamination method that's proprietary and not like what anyone else does. We had three people on the floor 3 years ago, and we've 14 now, and it's growing. And
you're exporting to China.
We're exporting to China. Yes, I mean, I know. You know.
Something like 40 million people play the piano in China. The size of the music market in China, and also their taste for high-end European products. Well, I mean, let's hope we don't, touch wood, we don't mess it up. But it's quite a big. There's quite an opportunity there. But the thing that's really great is we're plugging into manufacturing tradition here, where people have been having this stuff designed here and made in the Far East, and we're making the darn things by hand in England. The ply in the shell is so precise, it's cut by hand with a Stanley knife, and then it clicks into place in the shell. And there's this amazing, satisfying moment where the ply clicks in, and then you put the next one in and build up the ply like that. And there's just something about the satisfaction of, you know, it's carpentry, so it goes back to the dawn of all the way to the dawn of time.
So now, because I live near Southampton Dockyards, and I always think, oh, it's sad, there's nothing leaving on those ships. And now I know, in all those vast empty containers, one of those containers is going to be absolutely chock full of Al Murray's drum kit.
That's very, very likely.
That's so cool.
Yeah, we have this thing where the container comes, the container for America comes, and we have the whole floor fills the damn thing, and then off it goes. It's very exciting.
Oh, that's incredibly cool. Exciting. Man, makes me think I chose the wrong career path. So anyway, Alf,
we're looking for investors.
thank you so much for coming, bud.
It's a pleasure.
Really, on the podcast, it's been well overdue, and it's great. It's just great to share your passion of history with everyone out there.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's good to have someone. I mean, the thing about this is we could talk for. There's a time limit on these podcast things because people have lives.
we have been lost in a few wormholes.
Oh, God, it's been brilliant. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying, and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it, and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps, basically boosts up the chart, which is good, and then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't want to buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favor. Thanks.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.